First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Preventing more hate speech in the city of Jacksonville. Good morning. We are live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what local officials are doing to stop the displays of hate. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a little good news for your Wednesday, as we do every hump day. That and more ahead, but first this morning, local officials are mobilizing to prevent more hate speech that have been appearing with depressing regularity around town in recent months. Saturday night, the Jaguars' playoff victory was marred by more of this. A swastika and a cross were projected on the CSX building downtown, the latest message in a series of white supremacist hate messages that we have seen during high-profile football games. District 13 City Councilman Rory Diamond is one of two council members saying he'll sponsor legislation that would impose penalties on parties responsible for hate speech. He leads us off this morning and joins us by phone. Councilman, good to be with you.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for having us. It's 549-2937, folks. So tell us about this proposed legislation.
So what the bill would do, and it's going to be filed today by Council President Terrence Freeman, and it essentially makes it a crime to project one of these images on the side of a building without the building owner's consent. Now, it's content neutral, which means that you can't spray any message with one of these lasers on anybody's building without their consent, which means it will pass First Amendment muster. But clearly what we want to do is just stop this ridiculous hate speech, especially on the most high profile days for the city of Jacksonville.
Right. We've seen this type of thing during Florida Georgia weekend, during a series of Jaguars games. JSO some months ago said these messages aren't a crime and that they are protected by the First Amendment. Your response?
So if someone was putting something like this on a flag and standing on the corner and saying these terrible things, that would be protected First Amendment speech. But compelling a business owner or a property owner to hold that speech on the side of their building is not legal. And with this new law, we'll make it specifically illegal to do it without their consent. And again, like I said, it's content neutral, past First Amendment muster. We're not picking and choosing between messages. We're simply saying you can't do this. It'll be against the law. And it's a law with bite, too. The consequence would be a $2,000 fine minimum. Plus, after being arrested, if our state attorney, Melissa Nelson, wanted to further prosecute, we could ask for jail time.
Both CSX and Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry have issued statements condemning these hate messages. One of your colleagues, Leanna Cumber, another Republican on the city council and a mayoral candidate, is also introducing legislation. Would there be two competing pieces of legislation on this? How will this shake out?
No, I highly doubt it. As I understand it, there's two exact identical bills, which are modeled off of what the city of St. Petersburg did over on the other side of Florida. They have a perfect bill for us, so we borrowed it. It's circulated because the council people can't talk because of sunshine. There just happens to be two bills, and I'm sure one bill will go forward and get unanimous support. I'd be shocked if anyone on our council did not support this bill.
Councilman Rory Diamond, thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate you having me.
And as we continue the conversation, we'll go to your calls on this in a bit. The number to call in is 549-2937. As we welcome here in studio, Miriam Feast, President and CEO of the Jewish Federation of Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Claire Goforth, who covers hate groups and extremism movements for the Daily Dot. Hi, Claire.
Good morning.
549-2937. Miriam Feast, let's begin with you. Is the city council mounting an effective response, do you think, to what's been going on in Jacksonville?
Well, I think the legislation that's being presented today is absolutely a step in the right direction because we are working very closely with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, local FBI, and the National Organization of Secure Community Networks, all of which, working hand in hand. It's not criminal right now. So really, we're standing here with no action other than outrage and emotions that we're dealing with. So this legislation will be telling and important.
Mm-hmm. The Jewish Federation is working alongside the city, the sheriff's office, and other groups to combat anti-Semitism mm-hmm. and hate. Tell us what you're doing.
Thank you. First of all, the Jewish Federation and Foundation, its role both within the Jewish community and in the secular community, the greater community, is to be the convener. And that's what we're doing in this space. We're also blessed and grateful to David Miller and the Miller family for starting a Together Strong Community Fund, which will help finance this effort. And joined by a myriad of people that have influence and that can make a difference in this community. So that includes working with nonprofit leaders such as United Way, Community Foundation, One Jacks, 90 Forward, and many others, alongside business and civic leaders like the Jaguars Foundation, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Florida Blue, CSX, and others, ViStar, because they, along with faith leaders, we need to have a collective voice. It's not just anti-Semitism, it is hate. Hate begets hate. And we need to have a collective voice together to drown out those that have a very small but vile and hateful words.
Claire Goforth, Daily Dot. You know, we're talking not just about anti-Semitic hate speech, but hate speech in general. We'll go to calls and emails and tweets in a bit. Overwhelmingly now, people are messaging me to say, what about the issue of Confederate monuments? Monuments to racial hatred and white supremacy. Why is the city council moving on these anti-Semitic messages, as they should, but stalling on other messages that cause harm and are hateful and are very much seen by Black Americans and white Americans, too, we should say, as monuments to hate speech?
That's a very good point. And by refusing to take action on some of the Confederate monuments, the city council is effectively sending a message to people who are hate mongers that their views are acceptable in the city of Jacksonville. Now, by taking action on this particular bill, they are taking a stand against hate. But it's a mixed message, right? You're saying, well, we won't appropriate the funds to remove a Confederate monument, but someone projects an extremely vile, hateful, anti-Semitic message on a building, then we will take action. And to me, I think that what city council is facing is not only a black eye on the national stage, but also likely pressure from civic and business leaders on this particular issue, because it seems to occur when we have a very high-profile event, previously in Florida, Georgia, and this past week at the Jaguars, during the Jaguars playoff game, that these hate groups take an opportunity when Jacksonville has that national focus to try to spread their hatred.
Now, you research and write about hate groups here in Jacksonville and all over the country. What do we know about these extremist groups?
So the extremist groups that are active in Jacksonville currently, the National Socialist Florida and another group whose leader has recently relocated to Florida, Goyim Defense League, they are some of the most extreme hate groups that I have tracked in my career as I've been covering extremism for several years now with the Daily Dot and previously with Folio Weekly. While Florida is a hotbed for hatred. It really is. You know, if you want to be a famous actress, you move to Hollywood. If you want to break into country music, you move to Nashville. If you want to run a hate group, if you want to be involved in a hate group, increasingly what we see is you come to Florida, or you may already be here and you become radicalized. But what differentiates these two groups that are operating locally from some of the others that I've covered is while a group like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, they certainly are extremists and hateful, but they make an attempt to make their views seem more palatable. They deny being racist. They deny being anti-Semitic. That is not the case with these two groups. They're openly fascist. They're openly anti-Semitic. They deny the Holocaust. They hate black people. They hate anybody who is LGBT. They really just hate anyone who is not a white Christian heterosexual. And they're deeply sexist as well. I mean, these groups' rhetoric is despicable. It would shock you to read what they write openly. They really do not make any attempt to disguise who they are.
Let's go to your calls. 549 2937. Kate in Jacksonville. Hi, Kate. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am specifically directing this question to Rory Diamond. Why has it taken the city council 5 years to do or try to do anything about this? In July, we had a vote 13-19, the majority voting against taking down the Confederate monuments. I challenge him to make the city council go on record with their explanation of why they voted like this. So in the upcoming elections, we can vote them out because this is an extremely important issue to Northeast Florida.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you. Okay. Miriam Feast, obviously, as head of the Jewish Federation, you're grateful for the official support and condemnation. But what about this? And what do you think groups who are aligned with you, what about their message? What about their concerns?
That's a great question. And I follow suit of what was said about these hate groups. I mean, it's right now it's the swastika with the cross. Tomorrow it's, again, the banner being flown over about saving the Confederate. Hate begets hate. I think that for, as I mentioned, the groups, the nonprofits, the civic leaders, the business leaders, faith leaders, we need to be together. We need to convene. We need not to say that, oh, anti-Semitism is more important and is more at threat than any other type of hate. We need to forget that. We need to come together and we need to really have our voices joined together. And I think when that happens, we will see change. We will see change with elected officials. We'll see change in our schools. We'll see changes in our community.
We're getting so many tweets and emails. Seth tweets the show. So the council is okay with racist monuments, but racist lasers are a bridge too far. It's almost as if these two things are related. All right, Claire Goforth, there is an election coming up. Some of the candidates will be talking about this messaging. It may or may not, though, result in a real change in sentiment on the council after the elections, just given a number of factors, low turnout, gerrymandered districts, even though they have been slightly ungerrymandered by a federal judge's ruling. What do you think?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if there is a sea change in the council on the issue of Confederate monuments. You know, it's a mixed message, as I said. And one of the things that people ask again and again is, why Florida? You know, that's something I've given considerable thought to, why Jacksonville as well. And, you know, when a city council refuses to appropriate funds to remove a Confederate monument that's viewed as a symbol of hate, that sends a signal. When the governor and other politicians around the state, they go on and on and on about Antifa and vilify Antifa, when in reality, Antifa is anti-fascism. People who are fascists take that as a sign that what they're doing is acceptable. So when you have these messages coming from on high and around the state that say that, you know, we oppose the people who are your enemy, it makes people feel as though they have permission and then they have support on the highest echelons of government and society.
One listener emails the show, we need to stop making this a representation of Jacksonville in general, saying not everyone in town feels this way. At the same time, we have a tweet from Susan, why is Florida a hotbed for hate? And Peter tweets us, when will the city council recognize that brands like Four Seasons won't come to town if we protect racist monuments and hate groups? So, Miriam, what about that? As one listener says, this is a small minority sowing and spreading hate. Most people in town condemn this, but it creates a narrative, a national narrative, that Jacksonville is harboring hateful people, even though we are finally now seeing the city push back against this.
So that's an excellent point. And I think that, again, I keep harping on this, but I truly believe that this is the time, because the majority of people, like someone tweeted, in Northeast Florida does not believe in this. And we cannot allow a small group to define who we are. And I think that while we're waiting for politics and elected officials to to make these legislations or do these bills, and we know that takes time, mm-hmm. I again believe that when the community and nationally they see the leadership of Jacksonville, nonprofit, civic, business, faith leaders, standing proud, saying, this, we define Jacksonville. We define who we are. And this will not be tolerated. I think they'll start to see a groundswell. And I think that's what will start to make a difference.
Let us know your thoughts as we talk about bills in the city council that would criminalize the anti-Semitic hate displays we've seen projected onto downtown buildings. And there was one on TIAA Bank Field as well. Recently, 549-2937. Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Good morning to you. I just wanted to basically say what you already said about how the city's foot dragging on the monument issue has just opened the door for hatred. And as for Florida, we also have a governor that's very anti-immigrant, so that's not helping our image. But let me address specifically the plan that Councilmember Diamond presented. It fails to meet the need on two grounds. First, it does nothing to address the airplane flying over the stadium or the Proud Boys showing up at drag shows. And second, it doesn't address the root cause, which, again, we come back to the bastion of hate we have here and the Confederate monument, which just draws these people to the city of Jacksonville.
Thank you, Tom. Right. Let's talk about the banner that flew over the stadium. It showed the Confederate flag. It had a message saying it supported the monuments. Bill emails the show, put the names of the haters and those who support them in public view. Which pilot or company flew the banner? Ugly things grow in the dark. Public shaming or shunning can play an important role here. Claire.
Yeah, that is a very good point. Joshua Nunez runs National Socialists Florida. A person by the name of John Manadio runs the Goyim Defense League. Those are two people who we know are involved in those groups. They're publicly out there. And John, in John's case, actually, to his point, he moved to Florida because he was vilified in his home community in California due to his anti-Semitism and his hate.
And the banner, the company that agreed to pilot a plane to fly the banners over the stadium, that's been reported on.
Has it? I'm not aware of the company's name.
It's a local company. I don't have it at hand. However, that was also a high profile, actually more than one high profile incident of this.
Yes, it made Jacksonville look bad again on the national stage. You know, when we talked about the city council earlier and whether or not we're going to see change with the incoming council members, because there will be a lot of turnover, what I think about is that there, with the Confederate monuments, as opposed to this anti-Semitism, there are a significant number of people, particularly on the Republican base, who do support keeping the Confederate monuments. And when a politician is running, they're aware that there's a certain segment of their base that is not going to support them if they say they want to take the monuments down. Now, as a city, and as the leadership around the city probably agrees that we should take those down.
And I believe UNF polling on this issue showed the majority of Duval County voters are in favor of it as well.
Sure, but when you have a low turnout election and you have only your most engaged voters, then you know as a Republican that a significant number of those, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, they are going to oppose you if you want to take those monuments down, because there certainly is a strong vein of people who look at it incorrectly, in my view, as heritage, not hate.
Mandy tweets us, finally taking action on the displays is step one. Will the city move to take down the monuments? What about standing up for books that are being removed from school libraries, which help teach tolerance rather than hate? Miriam, she's referring to books being removed from school libraries in response to a new law limiting what can be taught to Florida students about our racial history.
Yes. It's, again, our voices. We have to show what the popular population wants in Florida, in Northeast Florida, and in Jacksonville. And if we don't want this and we don't tolerate this, then we have a responsibility to stand up, to stand out, to talk about it, and to vote. And that's what's going to make a swell of change, is not sitting back complaining about it, but actually taking action and doing something about it.
549-2937. Wells on the South Side. Wells of Take 'Em Down Jack's on the line. Hi, Wells.
Good morning. Good morning. And I just want to say I agree with people you have speaking this morning. You know, one of the things we need to look at here is the politicians and their stance, which everybody has said on your show, is just giving a green light to these white supremacists. Groups. But one of the things we need to look at is Governor DeSantis. Governor DeSantis has opened Florida up to all right-wing, white supremacists, and people who believe that they are better than everybody else. And he has said this. This is the free state of Florida, but it's the free state of Florida for right-wing reactionary white supremacists. And this is what he's pushing. I attend every single city council meeting to speak out for the need to remove these Confederate statues, which were put up to strike fear into the black community. They were put up to celebrate white supremacy. And so I think that that's the heart of this right now. And the city council has to come together and take these statues down. That's what I have to say this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Our own Will Brown lets us know that the people who flew the Confederate flyover over the stadium, a group called Save Southern Heritage, is actually based in Tampa, not Jacksonville. Thanks for that, Will. He says the group that supported keeping the monuments up, Unity Project of Jacksonville, told Save Southern Heritage they were not in favor of the flyover. So just some context, but it also reminds us that these groups are all over the state and the South and even the country. And so as we talk about this, we're going to take a couple of more calls. The number to join the show is 549-2937. We'll get a couple more of you in the queue on Facebook. Allison says, this is disgusting and disrespectful. Hate begins at home. Kids are not born with hate. They believe what they're growing up hearing from their parents. Scott on Facebook, the more attention the media gives this, the more active they will become. Miriam, do you agree with that? Or is it important to shine a light on this?
Absolutely. And I agree with what was said earlier also, that children are not born. They're born like sponges. And our work begins in our schools, in our places of worship, and in our communities to begin to change beliefs.
Don in Jacksonville. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Don Juan from Jacksonville.
Don Juan. So you're popular with the ladies then, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah,
I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
My question is, with all the issues that we have with the white supremacist, racist groups that have increased or grown in recent years, supposedly because in partially because of the influence of the Trump presidency. My question is, we have some Hispanic figures like Enrique Tarrio from the Proud Boys. Or we have Nick Fuentes, who's also Mexican-American descent. How do you explain these people that are of Hispanic descent, which is considered a minority? How do they fit into the picture? How do they become part of racist, neo-Nazi, white supremacist groups when they themselves are Hispanic descent? Enrique Tarrio himself, he describes himself as Afro-Cuban. Mm-hmm. So I wanted just to get some thoughts about that, why Hispanics would get involved in such groups if they're not really, in a way, truly Caucasian Anglo-Saxons?
Great question, Don. Claire, go forth.
It is a great question, and I have had this conversation with multiple people who work in the same space as I do, reporting on hate groups, most recently with a photojournalist who works for Reuters. And it's a very fine distinction here. The people who are of Hispanic descent who are involved in hate groups, they view themselves more through a European lens, and they differentiate themselves from Latinos. So they feel as though there is a difference there. They are not aware of the fact that if you go to the older, when you think of white supremacists in the United States, your mind maybe immediately turns to the KKK. They don't think of it like the KKK would hate me too. They think that they're different.
That's interesting. Exempt. Well, I appreciate that background. And I thank you both so much for being here. Miriam Feast, President, CEO, Jewish Federation of Northeast Florida. Claire Goforth of The Daily Dot. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we were earlier joined by Councilmember Rory Diamond. Much more still ahead. Later, a little good news for your Wednesday, but up next.
They were revealing to me the generational effects of the Holocaust. I'd never thought about that. The Holocaust did not end when the camp gates were open. For many people, it is still reverberating.
The new documentary film produced in Jacksonville, telling the stories of the second generation, as they're called, will explain next. Welcome back. It's a new and locally produced film giving voice to the children of Holocaust survivors. Traces, Voices of the Second Generation, tells the story of these children and their parents' remarkable accounts of surviving history's darkest evils. And the film shows how the Holocaust impacted their lives through its generational inherited effects. Stacey Goldring, who leads our book club on the show, is also the founder of Searching for Identity. She produced Traces to inspire all of us to rejoice in these second generation survivors and make sure their stories are remembered. The film is premiering later this month in Jacksonville. I got a preview from Stacey and director Isaac Brown.
Stacey, Isaac, good to be with you both. Stacey.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Let's begin with you, Stacey. Our listeners are very familiar with you as the leader of our monthly book club here on the show, but you're involved in a lot of other projects, including this very compelling new film. So what inspired Traces?
Back in 2013, Melissa, I started a writing workshop for children of Holocaust survivors. They're known as the second gen. I knew early on in this journey that the stories they were sharing in the workshop were not only about their parents' remarkable, remarkable experiences of survival, but they were revealing to me the generational effects of the Holocaust. I'd never thought about that. But Melissa, the Holocaust did not end when the camp gates were open. For many people, it is still reverberating generation to generation. I knew that these stories needed to be shared with the world. So here we are, almost 10 years later.
And Isaac, as director of the film, we meet some second-gen survivors local people. What did you learn in making this film? Tell us about your process.
Well, I co-directed with my wife, Ana Paula Habib, and I got to say, when Stacy first brought the topic to me, I was not fully understanding how deep the trauma runs through these families. And, you know, at first it was like, obviously, somebody going through the Holocaust and having children, I mean, it's a lot to take in. But when you really understand that, you know, without giving anything away, but really seeing how much it still affects people that are now grandparents, and mm-hmm. that this is something that happened, a lot of them before they were born, and a lot of them didn't make the connections of why their parents were the way they were until they became older and farther along in life. And it really kind of, when they all were able to get around each other through these writing workshops, and they realized all the similarities, and it's really kind of a fascinating look at how trauma can be passed down through families. And mm-hmm. and ultimately, I think it's a tale of resilience, because every one of these parents were excellent parents, and they managed to instill these wonderful family values in their children despite what they went through.
Despite surviving the horrors of the Holocaust. But as you say, Stacy, the trauma gets passed down, even if you try very hard not to pass that on to your children. What does this generation carry? What are their burdens?
Well, they have a choice, and that is whether to accept the responsibility to carry on the story, or, you know what, let it go. Enough already. Let's move forward. I have such respect for this generation, whether they choose to or not, because, like Isaac said, they're incredibly resilient individuals, and their story, it's universal. You know, trauma manifests, and we have a choice what to do with that trauma. Mm-hmm. We can let it govern us, or we can be inspired by it, and we can become resilient and pick up the pieces and move forward.
And I think that that is such an inspiring message that people will take away from this screening. Let me ask both of you, this is a timely film as we honor UN Holocaust Remembrance Day. And as we've been talking about on the program, efforts are rising around the community to combat a disturbing rash of hate speech in Jacksonville, in particular, anti-Semitic hate speech. So what are your hopes for how this project can contribute to fighting against that hate?
Anti-Semitism is an ancient phenomenon, and I don't have any illusions that this film will make it go away, but I'm hopeful that it will add to the conversation, and hopefully people that have those sorts of inclinations after seeing it will be a little more in touch with their humanity and understand that these are people too, and these are not so easily, you know, pigeonholed into whatever their preconceived notions of who they are.
These acts are based in fear and ignorance. Every one of these acts, and I don't like to use the word anti-Semitism, because it seems it covers up what it is, which is hatred of Jewish people and wanting them dead. I look at what we're doing as a way of putting understanding and compassion out in the world. And that's infectious. Every time an incident like this happens, Melissa, it is an opportunity for everyone who witnesses it to say, what am I going to do about it? Right? And the first thing, of course, I would suggest is, you know, please support the work of Searching for Identity, because we're doing this every day. And come see the film. Engage, have empathy. These people that are doing this, they're hurting.
Thank you both. Stacy Goldring, producer, and Isaac Brown, director, as Searching for Identity presents the premiere of Traces, Voices of the Second Generation, giving voice to the children of Holocaust survivors. Come to the premiere Saturday, January 28th, 7:30 p.m. at the Wilson Center for the Arts on the FSCJ South Campus. with a Q&A to follow the screening. WJCT Television is the film's premier partner, and you will be able to watch the film on WJCT Television on January 29th and 30th.
Again, that's Traces, Voices of the Second Generation, Sunday at 4 p.m. on January 29th, Monday, January 30th at 10 p.m. on Jax PBS 7.1. Children with obesity should be offered more intensive treatment options earlier, including therapy and medication, so says the leading U.S. pediatricians group. The American Academy of Pediatrics has new guidance out on childhood obesity, their first in 15 years. And they're moving away from what they call watchful waiting or delaying treatment to see if kids just outgrow obesity. A local doctor played a role in this study. Here with more, we welcome on the line Madeline Joseph, MD, Medical Director of UF's Pediatric Weight Management Center at UF College of Medicine Jax and Local District Chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you. So with childhood obesity skyrocketing, why did the American Academy of Pediatrics decide to issue this new guidance?
This has been work in the work for the last couple of years. And it's really past due because the previous guidelines were in 2007. So there is a huge body of literature that is leading to these guidelines. So we're very excited about the release of these guidelines.
You were involved with the new guideline recommendations. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I'm one of many authors on these guidelines, and it's many experts from all over the country in the field of obesity medicine, endocrinology, and general pediatrician as well. And we also had a family representative on the guideline who was extremely helpful as well, because each one of these recommendations were evaluated by that parent or by that family representative to also give us the family perspective on how practical these guidelines could be. And this truly been working for the last several years and many meetings and review and literature. And if you look at the references, there's over 500 studies that were used to develop these guidelines.
And why the call for more urgency and intervening earlier with young children, even considering weight loss drugs for kids as young as 12?
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the data, there's over 14 million children and teens in the country that are impacted by this complex chronic disease. And the watchful waiting, which is, typically basically saying that we hope that the child will outgrow their obesity, did not work. And we can see many of the children and teens, especially the teenagers, if they're struggling with obesity, they're going to carry that disease into adulthood. And more we're seeing children suffering from diseases that typically used to be diseases of adulthood, such as high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and so forth. And so the urgency comes from what we're seeing now. And of course, the pandemic kind of accelerated the weight gain, with children being at home, isolated, not being in sports. That's a testimony that the environment really impact this disease, and that's where the urgency came from.
The AAP also calls for a whole child approach to treating childhood obesity, looking at not just diet and exercise, but genetics, socioeconomic factors. So how will doctors take that on?
That's a great question. And truly, we have to look at the entire environment, right? I mean, we call it obesogenic, you know, meaning the our own environment where we live and how we live is contributing to obesity. Even if we look at our own city, you know, access to parks, you know, not having sidewalks to be able to walk, you know, biking is not really practical. There's no safe path for biking. And so even if you look at the infrastructure of, you know, where we live, is it conducive, you know, to be in physically active? But also the social determinant of health, because really, like, when we look at the community access to healthy food, to, you know, places where they can be active, the stress that, you know, some of our children go through, food insecurity, you know, these are the type of things that we really need to pay attention to, you know, in healthcare, because, you know, it is not, you know, eat right and exercise and everything will be perfect. I mean, it is really looking at the environment we're in, you know, physiologically, environmentally, and from the socioeconomic point of view as well.
Now, this new guideline to treat childhood obesity comes on the heels of a new drug that's been approved for kids 12 and up, a new weight loss medicine called Wegovy. This is an injection. It's also used to treat diabetes. Tell us more about this new medication.
Yes, and I just wanted to put it in a you know, bigger perspective. So when we're treating obesity, we really have to look at the environment the child is in, you know, access to, you know, healthy food, being physically active, and really looking at intensive health, behavior, lifestyle, you know, treatment, motivational interviewing, and then we talk about the, you know, medication. And fortunately, the medication, and this is a new study that was just recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they did use it for children 12 and older, and they did see significant decrease in BMI, 16% for the group that was treated with the Wegovy versus the BMI dropped only 0.6%. And they looked at, you know, 68 weeks, so this is over a year period, and about 73% of the children that were treated with this medication had weight loss more than 5%. And we always say if the child with obesity lost about 5 to 10% of their weight, they can get rid of a lot of the complications of obesity. And so that's why this is so significant. But I just want to, you know, mention that we should never look at medication alone. I think we should look at medication as being one of the many tools in the toolbox, and really be cautious, you know, as we prescribe it, you know, looking at side effects and also cost. I mean, this medication, I think it's about $1,300 a month. Exactly. And so that could be a barrier by itself. And it really.
Absolutely.
Right,
well,
anyone.
Sure. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for participating in this national study and joining us. Dr. Madeline Joseph, Medical Director of UF's Pediatric Weight Management Center. Thank you so much, Doctor.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And in a moment, we'll pick you up on this hump day with a little good news for your Wednesday. We'll be right back.
The Florida Forum, benefiting Wolfson Children's Hospital, speaker series welcomes 11-time Olympic medalist Allison Felix on January 18th. Ticket info, visit thefloridaforum.com or the Women's Board office at 202-2886.
Navigating the emergency room. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me Saturday at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
Malcolm Jamal Warner is well known for his TV roles, including the iconic Theo Huxtable, but he's also a musician whose latest spoken word album is up for a Grammy.
I've learned to discern who cannot accept all of me. I read the room before I speak, because I find that folks flee from honesty like we retreat from love.
Warner on his career in the spotlight and behind the mic on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
Next time on The World, the exodus from Cuba. People have been leaving the island for years, but experts say we are now seeing the largest single wave of Cuban migrants in the history of migration out of Cuba since even before the revolution.
There really is a sense in Cuba right now that a lot of people feel that they've lost hope in the country.
Cubans explain why they're leaving. Their story on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Prince Harry's memoir continues to make money and headlines, and like his mother, he has no qualms about speaking out.
He's changed. She must be a witch. Yeah, I did change. I'm really glad I changed.
Interest in Harry and Meghan's story is sky high in America, but will it change minds at the palace and with his father, the new king? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. We'll enjoy our beautiful weather and come on out tomorrow night for the third Thursday Sip and Stroll, brought to you by Downtown Vision and PNC. This is a free riverfront happy hour event. It kicks off tomorrow at 5 p.m. You stroll along the riverfront, listen to live music, enjoy some food. There are bars, free picnic blankets while supplies last, kid-friendly activities, even an after-party and silent disco at the Doubletree. Dogs on leashes are welcome. If you've never been out to Sip and Stroll on the South Bank Riverwalk, go check it out. It's tomorrow night. Lots of fun. And here's some more good news for your Wednesday. More people are moving to Florida every day. We are the 8th most populated state in the nation. New arrivals may be unfamiliar with the use of prescribed fire in Florida to protect communities. We actually lead the nation in this, I'm told. The Florida Forest Service Wakasasa Forestry Center is going to celebrate Prescribed Fire Awareness Week next week with their second annual Flatwoods Fire and Nature Festival. This is coming up Saturday, January 28th from 10 to 5 a.m. at the UF IFAS Austin Cary Forest Campus north of Gainesville. This is a celebration of Florida's forests and the role of fire in maintaining and enhancing their beauty, diversity, and habitat value. More good news around the area. The Jimenez Fadio House Museum, a long-standing fixture of historic Aviles Street in St. Augustine, is relaunching their Black History Tours. I Lived Here As Well, Together, they're called, and they kick off January 19th and run through February 25th. You can come out and see them at 10 a.m. each week on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday mornings. Tours open to the public and led by costumed historical actors. You step into this 225-year-old boarding house and experience firsthand the stories of the people that lived within it. The I Lived Here As Well program is a series of interpretive Black history tours where you really get a deeper sense of St. Augustine's rich past, so check that out. All right, here's another fun one. Celebrate the Chinese New Year with a 2023 Lunar New Year celebration gala held by the Jacksonville Chinese Association. Now, this is coming up Saturday, 3 p.m. at the John Delaney Student Union at UNF. The gala features Chinese and English songs, folk and modern dances, martial arts. That sounds interesting. Poetry, fashion show, a lot more. And this is free and open to the public. Hundreds of audience members are expected to join this lively celebration of what the local Chinese community has to offer. There will even be a multinational technology corporation sponsoring the event. It has been JCA's tradition to hold this annual gala to promote the Chinese New Year and strengthen ties between East and West. They had to stop during the pandemic, so they're excited to be celebrating the Lunar New Year once again on the UNF campus this Saturday. And on Friday, the City of Atlantic Beach, a Tree City USA designee, will invite everyone to come on out and celebrate Arbor Day. This kicks off at 9 a.m. Friday in front of the Atlantic Beach Police Station. That's at that five-way intersection, with opening remarks by Mayor Curtis Ford and others, along with other dignitaries, and an Arbor Day flag raising. Then you're going to walk over to Atlantic Beach Elementary School, where they'll have a tree planting, before walking over to Bull Park, where a heritage tree plaque will be unveiled. The City of Atlantic Beach is committed to preserving and enhancing their tree canopy, and Arbor Day, much like Earth Day, celebrates nature. Its purpose is to encourage us to plant trees. Many communities traditionally take the opportunity to organize tree planting and litter collecting events on or around Arbor Day, which is Friday. So lots happening this week. Get out and enjoy it, folks. And if you've got a tasty item you'd like us to add to our weekly Wednesday menu, well, then just drop us a line. And thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks also to our team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, and Josh Torres directing today. To get in touch, just email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We love hearing from you. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thanks for the company, and make it a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.